too often, I think, people want to put politicians in a binary box of progressive or moderate, when in reality, this group is less concerned about the hardline ideologies and more committed to just simply getting stuff done.
Well, there's Seattle Mayor Bruce Harrell when he first introduced what amounts to a brand new city council just a few months ago. So now that he has a team of council members he endorsed, what's he going to do with that? What sort of pressure is he under to deliver? Plus, what is next as these council members start their committee work off this week? And what does it mean that Seattle's graffiti law has been reinstated by the courts? Well, we are discussing those topics and so much more this week on Seattle News, Views, and Brews, your coffee break political podcast. I'm Brian Callinan. I'm a host on the Seattle Channel. The views expressed here are mine, and I am back with co-host David Croman, City Hall reporter for the Seattle Times. And David, I got to say, it almost feels like we're back in school again. What's it been like to see all the major review courses that these new city council members have been going through just to get up to speed?
Yeah, I mean, it's illuminating. You kind of know in theory that they're all new, but until you have somebody explaining that, you know, it's the Sound Transit Board that decides where the stations go, you realize how much they have to learn.
There is always a lot to learn. That is very true. Well, thank you, David, as always, for joining me. Thanks also to our background noise sponsor, City Grind Espresso, on the first floor of City Hall. Thanks also to our show patrons. A shout out to Linda for her continued support of the show and timely messages as well. Thank you, Linda. And patrons, we are trying something out new this week, answering patron questions, hoping to make that a regular part of the show. So if you can pledge just $5 a month to the show, we will do our best to answer your questions. Plus, you can access Patrons First podcasts, like the one we had last week with Representative Mia Gregerson. What a deal for you. Thank you, patrons, for your support. A big thanks also to Converge Media. The video version of this podcast is on Converge. You can watch it Wednesday nights at 7. All right, let's get rolling. Time for Right Here, Right Now. Well, David, we have touched on the support that Bruce Harrell has from this city council over the past few weeks, but you recently put it to the mayor himself in an article in the Seattle Times after endorsing five candidates, seeing all of them win, having what appears to be the tightest mayor-council relationship Seattle has had in a long time. Is he under pressure to deliver? How did he respond to you with that question?
Yeah, I mean, he kind of paused and said, yes, I think so. Harrell is, you know, he's an ex-football player. You know, he likes doing like leadership classes. You know, he likes sort of thinking.
Yeah.
He's kind of, I don't want to say like a rah-rah guy, but he's social and likes the limelight. And so he kind of responds as you might expect, which is, you know, this is an opportunity. I live for this pressure. This is,
yeah.
But yes, it's pressure, but it's pressure that, you know, I embrace and that I want.
Mm-hmm,
and so
mm-hmm.
not entirely surprising to hear from him.
I guess in terms of how he's worked it out with the council here, it's a little bit of a novel concept, at least in terms of recent Seattle city politics here, having a mayor endorse as many candidates as Bruce Harrell did. And in the past, the council has always kind of been, at least the way I've seen it over the past decade plus, the council has kind of been this convenient scapegoat when things don't go exactly as planned. But Mayor Harrell doesn't really have that excuse, I would say. I'm trying to figure out what this mayor-council dynamic is going to look like going forward. How's it going to play out? What do you think?
For me, kind of a big thing about this is, you know, in addition to getting, you know, almost hand-picking the council in some ways, it's the council is just so extremely new. They're so green to this job. You know, we're hearing in their committee hearings, just basic briefings about what the departments do that they are governing.
Sure.
Whereas, so in addition to having a friendly council, Bruce Harrell has been in that building for 14 years between being on city council and mayor, and so he doesn't have to do any of that. And so I think it's as much as important as it is that he has kind of allies on the city council. He just knows how the system works, and at a time when they're probably going to be looking for leadership, he's going to be there to steer them. So that sort of, you know, doubles up his power, in my opinion. But yeah, you're right. I mean, I think, you know, the city council, you know, according to polling that I've heard seen and talked about, the city council has been the unpopular part of City Hall for the last few years. They poll terribly. Whereas, you know, mayors, they're not always resoundingly popular, but they're somewhere around 50%, sometimes north of that. And so now, you know, the city council, as we know it, is no longer in existence. And so my question is some of the focus going to shift over to Mayor Harrell? Because, you know, he is the guy in charge now in a way that really no mayor that I can remember has been able to say.
Yeah. One quick sidebar, and you touched on this in your piece, the relationship between the Seattle City Council, the city of Seattle, really, and the King County Regional Homelessness Authority. It seems like Mayor Harrell wants to change that. I think that's a big deal because I know the city council in years past has really wanted to be a team player with that KCRHA. I don't think the mayor doesn't want to be a team player, but he really wants to change that relationship possibly. Can you touch on that briefly?
Yeah, that was kind of, I would say, the most kind of specific. So, I mean, one thing I kept asking him is, so there's this new council. I mean, what does that mean for how you were going to look at City Hall differently? And
yeah,
he wasn't always super direct in his answers about that. But the one place he was kind of clear is we're going to scrutinize our relationship with specifically the King County Regional Homelessness Authority and, interestingly, King County Public Health or Public Health Seattle King County.
Right.
And, you know, that was interesting to me. I think we've kind of known that he has had a skeptical eye toward at least the Homelessness Authority for a couple of years. There were those comments that came out, I think, on, you know, Jason Rance's show that he gave to the police department kind of behind the scenes. And so it was sort of private skepticism about that body. But what struck me is now that skepticism is very much public, that he's kind of saying out loud what he was saying in private before, which is Seattle is funding these bodies at huge levels. And I'm not convinced that it's getting the results that we want for those dollars.
Yeah, that's going to be a relationship that'll be very interesting to see play out. Again, the KCRHA is undergoing a leadership change right now, has a new interim leader coming in, so we'll see.
That interim leader, by the way, played football with Bruce Harrell at Garfield. They were teammates back in high school.
Yeah, so. I'm really interested to see how that's going to go. That one is fraught, and I want to make sure we come back to it in a week or so here, David. But let's move on to the city council, because the council is starting its work on committees this week, and a lot of it is, like you were saying before, welcome to the Department of Transportation, agenda items like that. But I noticed that Councilmember Morales is really kicking things into gear as chair of the Land Use Committee. And I suppose she'd better, because there's a comprehensive plan update due by the end of the year. Specifically, she is presenting an equitable development, zoning, and connected communities pilot plan this week. That's a mouthful, but I wanted your take on this. It's a zoning proposal. They're trying to make sure there's more equitable development around the city. But it appears to be one of the first real major decision points for the council beyond filling the council vacancy they were doing a few weeks ago. Councilmember Morales is asking for a committee vote on this in the first week of March. Any insight on how these new council members will approach this issue? Some thoughts on housing here, Dave.
What's sort of interesting about coming into this job from transportation is I wasn't on the campaign trail, so I didn't get a chance to ask them all of these questions personally. You know, my sense is that, you know, there were a few options that came out in the comprehensive plan around how the city might change its housing policies. And the one that seems like most of these members have said they wanted is the one that, you know, allows a lot more housing near transit and stretches, and in some of the neighborhood villages, and maybe kind of stretches a little bit outside of those, and some modest changes. It's not quite the alternative six that people were pushing for that was, you know, upzones across the city, but it's sort of this, it's a very Seattle approach, which is like targeted specific upzoning. And so Morales, on the other hand, I think she has been a little more, she's wanted to go a little further on this stuff than they have. Frankly, you know, she is the committee chair, so she has that power to control the narrative on that. But, you know, as we know and have talked about, she doesn't have the votes for it without compromise.
Right.
And so, yeah, how that relationship will play out between her as somebody kind of leading these discussions on committee and the rest of the council that might be a little more reticent to jump into a lot more density in the city, then, you know, that'll be interesting. We'll see.
Yeah, and you're going right down the path I wanted to take with you here, because I just am very interested to see how Councilmember Morales is going to be working on her agenda with the council for the next few years. She is clearly no fan of what the mayor has done to stack things against her. She even said during the Tanya Wu confirmation hearings, hey, remember, everybody, how this all went down with these business interests influencing so many things here. Now the council selected somebody for the seat. Remember this when you vote in November for the position 8 job. So I guess looking at this, though, if she wants something done, she's going to need another 4 votes. And she does run a very important committee with land use here. Where is she going to get them, and how? How do you see that developing with Councilmember Morales?
Yeah, again, it's hard to know because we haven't seen, I mean, these members haven't voted on anything except for how to fill the vacancy. You know, on that, what was it? Five people ended up voting for Tanya Wu.
Right.
Four for somebody else. I think three if there had been a second round, three for someone else. Right, right. Dan Strauss, her, and Joy Hollingsworth all voted for somebody else. You've got to think Tanya Wu would vote more closely with the people that put her on. So then that's a 6-3 equation. And Dan Strauss and Joy Hollingsworth are not, I would say, even close to considered as, you know, progressive or however, whatever term you want to use, as Tammy Morales. So I think she would, whatever she wants to do, she'd have to start with those two and then kind of see where she can go from there. But, you know, frankly, if she wants to pass any legislation, it has to be, it's going to have to include members who, so far, we've seen as kind of voting in a block, although it's way too early to know kind of where those divisions might exactly land.
True. We really haven't seen any policy decisions in front of them. And I think this may be one of the first ones here, David. So I'm interested to track this. Very interested to see how Tammy Morales presents herself and connects with other council members on these important issues, because that comprehensive plan, that update is due by the end of this year, and there's been a lot of delay behind it. So we will see what happens there with that development over the course of the next couple of weeks. All right, we'll move on to our next section here, folks. A new directive from the State Liquor and Cannabis Board after their first directive that, well, it didn't sit very well with Capitol Hill's gay bars and clubs. What's been going on? Listen up on Now Hear This. Well, last weekend, end of January, several gay bars and clubs on Capitol Hill were surprised to see a crackdown from the Seattle Police Department and the Liquor and Cannabis Board. The concern: a number of citations were issued over clothing and decency violations, otherwise known as lewd conduct violations. That led to some club owners testifying in Olympia with the LCB to say the state and the city are targeting gay men because of their clothing choices.
It's for this reason that we call for an update and a modernization to the policy that respects adult human behavior and expression, and also that is curated towards the LGBTQ community, because our spaces operate differently, and our personal dedication to their safety is paramount. It's our number one goal. And to invade a safe space and deem it offensive is deeply troubling and traumatic.
That's Kevin Cower, the owner of Massive, a new club up on Capitol Hill. Cower with many years of experience in the business. And just a few days after this testimony, it was interesting to see this, the state said it would suspend its lewd conduct inspections and pause its participation with the city's joint enforcement team, which includes the SPD. Councilmember Hollingsworth on the council, the city council here, even got involved, saying she was concerned these inspections could be viewed as hostile to Seattle's LGBTQ community. And David, I was concerned about this and interested in this because I'm just not sure what the LCB's next move is. They're planning to update this law somehow on February 14th. Happy Valentine's Day to everybody on that one. But will the LCB put some new rules in place to say, okay, men showing nipples, which happened to be the citation for one of the people involved here, yes, that's okay, but two nipples, we're drawing the line. It just feels like the LCB stepped into such a mess here. What do you make of what's happening?
Yeah, for sure. I mean, this got national coverage. These raids or whatever you want to call them.
Sure.
It just feels like it has fallen into this bureaucratic abyss where there was sort of language around this stuff. But then when you once you get into the territory of debating whose nipples and how many of them are allowed out in a bar, boy, you don't envy the people whose job it is to kind of carry out the code. But, you know, at the same time, there are all kinds of sort of crazy rules and laws on the books, and plenty of them we don't enforce. And it's all a lot of this is very discretionary. You know, maybe this was happening quietly before we ever heard about it through, I think The Stranger was the first to publish something about it. But yeah, I don't know what changed exactly between the last however many years I've been a reporter in Seattle and now, like why this became such an urgent matter for them to do that. But I guess I would be surprised if this did not lead to some kind of change, just because I have not seen anybody publicly defend kind of busting down the doors on a gay bar because somebody had a nipple out.
If anything, the LCB has put out the message saying, okay, message received. That's what I read about this. They're trying to take this information in and change it. And I don't know where the Seattle police play a role in this one, David. Do you have any thoughts on that? They seem kind of caught in the middle here. It's like the state's asking for them to take part with this joint enforcement team, and there go the SPD trying to enforce these different laws. That got a little weird, too, I think.
Yeah, I don't. I would be lying if I said I understood exactly how that relationship works.
Yeah, it's just it's one of those things where we're going to learn a lot more about it in the next week or so. But I know this was quite a kerfuffle up on Capitol Hill, and I'm hoping that it's something that the LCB can work out with these club owners or what have you. What started as I think an attempt to enforce the law turned into something that was a little more than what was bargained for. Let's call it that. All right. Yeah. I want to work on to another law enforcement issue that you were reporting on here, David, specifically Seattle's graffiti law recently instated by the Court of Appeal. So I just want the backstory on this, David, because when you wrote about this for the Times, you were talking about how Seattle City Attorney Ann Davison was hoping to win this argument with the Court of Appeals, and it looks like she did. Talk to me about this. What's the backstory and where are we now with this?
Yeah, so this came up. I mean, it's really strange. This came up. It was kind of the long tail of the 2020 protests. So there was just a lot of tension and a lot of protests. And
yeah,
I think particularly between protesters and the Seattle Police Department. So there was these four people who wrote some stuff on chalk, including F the police, mm-hmm. on a, you know, city owned wall. They got arrested under this graffiti law, and they sued saying, you know, this is basically a free speech and 14th Amendment violation. Lower court district judge, Judge Marsha Peckman, who's, you know, a senior judge at this point. She's been around forever. I think she was appointed by Clinton, agreed with them, basically said, stretch the argument out a little further. Like, so are we going to start arresting kids for drawing in chalk on parades and things like that? And at first she threw out the entire, public property destruction law, saying,
yes,
you know, if this one piece is unconstitutional, the whole thing falls apart. Mm-hmm. Then she kind of clarified and said she was really just talking about the graffiti part, but still she tossed out the city's ability to enforce graffiti laws. Mm-hmm. Ninth Circuit, it came back and said that argument, you know, she stretched it too far, basically saying, mm-hmm. she was coming up with hypothetical scenarios that would not be tested. And, you know, on a whole, that the law should be constitutional. And so we're barring an appeal to the Supreme Court. You know, the lawyer who was representing the four plaintiffs in this seemed to suggest that they thought there was some way they could go back to Peckman and kind of get a narrower ruling. I don't know if they've done that yet, but for now, full speed ahead on graffiti enforcement.
Yeah, and I guess I was trying to figure out what that looks like. What does that mean for the future of graffiti enforcement in Seattle? Because I know when Ann Davison was a candidate and was running for this job, this was one of the pillars of her campaign. You know, we're going to clean up graffiti. We're going to get rid of this urban blight. It can attract other problems into neighborhoods or what have you. What do you think about enforcing, this graffiti law going forward? And how's the city going to do that?
Yeah, I don't know. I mean, because as we know, there are not a lot of cops for this. I think it was, what was the number? Yeah. 900?
Yes,
about that. Year. Most of them misdemeanors, so most of them going to the state attorney's office. The Seattle Police Department isn't even writing speeding tickets hardly now. So I think it's a good question whether graffiti is going to actually be enforced. You're right. I mean, this is very central to Ann Davison's campaign. You know, calling something broken windows theory is a little loaded because there's a lot that comes with that. But at its core, that is what this is, which is, public disorder is not just public disorder. It's a sign and a breeding ground for worse crime, which was basically the idea behind the broken windows policing. I think there's a lot of debate around whether that's true.
True or not. Yeah. Yeah.
Agreed. Yeah. But you know, at the end of the day, I think this city hall and the city attorney, you know, driving down I-5 or whatever, see graffiti and disorder and they just don't like it. They think it reflects poorly on the city. And so there's not a lot of disagreement in City Hall right now, especially with this new city council, that it's a thing that the city should prioritize.
And it looked like you talked a little bit with the mayor's office about this too. The idea was to try to get, in terms of enforcing it, I guess, try to really go after some of the prolific graffiti perpetrators, if you want to call them that. And then for more low-level crimes or whatever else, try to figure out some way to refer them to community service or something like that. Did that seem like the balance the mayor's office was looking for here?
That was the idea. I mean, yeah, it's the same kind of language, frankly, that they use around drug use or, as if they're splitting it into dealers and users or whatever. I have no idea how they identify who is a prolific graffitier, whether they have a dossier on the people who tag the most or whatever it might be. You know, they seem to suggest, we'll come up with alternative forms of artistic expression. And the people I've known who have done graffiti are do it in part because of the act of, you know, being daring and doing it in a place that they shouldn't be doing it. I think that's a part of the activity. So good luck with that. I don't know what the sort of broad policy is to crack down on a thing that every city has, but
right,
open to ideas.
Yeah, and it looks like the city attorney is very open to pursuing these cases. So we'll see what happens next, and we'll see if it has an impact on the city of Seattle in terms of how much graffiti is around, too, which I guess is the bottom line here. All right, well, coming up, a new segment on the show. We are responding to our patrons' questions about city issues. Got a concern about the budget and where cuts might come from? That's coming up on You Ask, We Answer. All right, patrons, thank you for your input on this. Please just keep reaching out to us on Patreon with your questions. We'll work on answering them. Or you can reach us at seattlenewsviewsandbrews@gmail.com. It's a spelling test and an email address all in one. Here's the question from Eric, who asks this, David. Here we go. We are entering a budget crunch. Danny Westneat, columnist for the Times, suggested shutting down the SLUT. That's the South Lake Union trolley. It's now known as the streetcar. Thank you very much, Eric. Because the operations cost is over $20 per passenger boarding. I'm concerned about wasting money on frivolous mega project studies like high-speed rail and lidding downtown. Can you say what's on the chopping block and what you think should be on the chopping block? Eric, thanks for the question. David, let me jump on the streetcar issue first here. I actually asked Councilmember Hollingsworth about this on my last Council Edition show, this specific question. Eric has been wanting to know more on this for a little while, and here's how she responded to me.
I talked about it during the campaign trail that I think we have other priorities in our city, transportation-wise, that I think are very important, from our sidewalks to our crosswalks to ensuring that, you know, our roads repair, potholes, like just the basic functionality of our city. And so that's something I couldn't put my weight behind right now and advocating for other things in our city to be prioritized.
Bottom line, Eric, that's the Transportation Committee vice chair there. I'm not seeing a lot of support for the streetcar. I don't know if we can call it dead and gone yet, but it certainly doesn't have a lot of support from this no-nonsense council we're dealing with here. But I did want to talk about this larger issue of what's on the chopping block, David. You've been talking with council members who spoke to this issue of auditing the budget when they're on the campaign trail. What are you hearing from them now?
Yeah, we did hear we're going to audit the budget a lot. And we really heard it a lot in the applications for the open council seat. I think it was sort of it was like a chorus of audit the budget.
Catchword.
I think to an extent, I don't know. I mean, there's a semantic game to that to a certain extent. I don't know exactly what they meant by audit. If they mean literally audit, like do what we consider a real audit, that's not happening. Because as Council Member Rob Saka said yesterday, who on the campaign trail was a guy who used the term audit the budget, basically that costs a lot of money and takes a really long time to do it. Real audit of the budget. I think it happens eventually. There are agencies that do this, and they have a Washington State auditor who does these audits sometimes. So it's a thing that happens sometimes. I don't think there's going to be a brand new audit of it. What's actually probably going to happen, and I don't know if this is what they meant by using that term, is what the council does every year, which is review the budget. And what the executive does every year is review the budget, decide what they want to prioritize and what they want to cut, and make those cuts. They're being kind of mum on what could be cut. You know, one approach that I think is on the table is taking the jumpstart tax, which is intended for housing, and basically transferring it all to plug the budget hole and calling it a day. That would make a lot of people really upset, but it would be kind of an easy math equation. Mm-hmm. You know, I think we could see some looks at places like the Office of Labor Standards or some of the kind of darlings of the last council, you know, Department of Neighborhoods, Office of Sustainability. You know, I don't know what they are exactly. This is not based on anything I've heard so far specifically from the council, but I think a lot of the things that maybe grew over the last year that were funded by federal funding or emergency funds that the last council wanted to keep going, I think that a lot of that kind of stuff could maybe fall away. Yeah. And then, you know, I mean, some of it might just be accomplished by not hiring people who, you know, not hiring replacements. I mean, there is a hiring freeze.
That hiring freeze is a big deal. And when you went down that list, something else kind of jogged in my mind too, the different efforts that the previous council went through to protect renters in different ways and the amount of resources that they had dedicated towards that. I think it's very important to point out that Chama Sawant was head of that Renters' Rights Committee for several years. And that Renters' Rights does not appear in any of the committee titles at all this time through. So I wonder if that might be an indication as well. And any thoughts on that side of it?
No, I think that's right. I think that's right. I mean, again, it kind of goes back to, you know, this council ran very explicitly against the last council in a way that has not happened since at least I've been a reporter. You know, obviously there are individual competitions. This was a collective running against the previous council. And so I think talking to them, I know they feel like they have a mandate. And part of that mandate, I think, is probably undoing some of the work of the previous council. And so I think where there will be some skepticism is around some of the labor stuff, some of the, you know, some of the stuff around gig workers or, you know, gig companies and things like that, which again goes back to Office of Labor Standards. I don't know if Office for Civil Rights or things like that. Again, I don't have intel on what exactly they want to cut. I just know what I have heard that they have been skeptical of. And, you know, I think those are going to get a close look.
Yeah, no, I think you're right. And I actually was on a KUOW program a few weeks ago where Council President Nelson was on there, and I was able to ask her that question about Jumpstart. Are you going to end up, you know, spending it to plug up this budget hole? And she said, yeah, we might. And I said, well, wasn't this a program that was put in place to try to help with things like affordable housing and the Green New Deal? And she basically answered in the way you just described, David. It's like, well, that's what the previous council thought. But here we, so it was kind of, I think that really is part of the mantra right now is, I don't know if using that last council as a whipping post or whatever else for their different ideas over this next little bit is going to be the way it's going to go. But I think you might be onto something there when it comes to, all right, this is what our last council did. We are here to change things going forward. And I guess they're just unabashed about that is my take on that. And I wonder what happens next. Do you have that feel as well?
Yeah, I maybe they do something, maybe they don't. I just think they feel zero obligation to have any continuity between the policy priorities of the last council and the policy priorities of this council. And that could very well mean just completely undoing the intention of the jumpstart tax. I think eventually it could mean rolling back the jumpstart tax. That's not going to happen this year because of the budget crunch. But yeah, I don't think anything, unless it's legally protected, I don't know that anything is sacred. The sweetened beverage tax, there's another one. You know, that has, that's theoretically earmarked for specific programs, but it's not legally earmarked. So there's not a lot stopping this council from moving it to plug the budget hole.
Yeah. Thank you for encapsulating that, David. I'm very interested to see what happens next. And thank you very much, Eric, for engaging that question. Again, if you want to send us a question, we are going to work on answering them just about every week here, folks. So send them in. I'll make sure I send out a note on Patreon as well. If you're one of our $5 a month patrons or up, we'll make sure we get those answers to you. All right, David, it is time to wrap up, and it is Super Bowl weekend coming up. I got to say, you've got one of the best stories I've heard when it comes to where were you when the Seahawks won the Super Bowl in 2014. I saw you post about this. What the heck was going on in 2014, man?
Yeah, I was in Laos and traveling with my now wife. And so, yeah, we got up at 6 in the morning, Laos time, to go to a bar, and it was actually it was packed. The whole bar was super crowded with people traveling, and there's some like international channel that broadcasts the Super Bowl, but it's not the announcers you're used to back home. It's announcers that are catering to a much less informed audience about the NFL. And so instead of, you know, sharp analysis or whatever, they're just explaining basically the rules of football. So, you know, it was entertaining.
A different way to see the game. And no matter how you slice it, the Hawks actually won that one. And I can dream back to that date as well. So, well, thank you very much, David, for joining me. And thanks to everybody listening in to Seattle News, Views, and Brews, where you can always find out what's brewing in local politics. Thanks especially to our patrons, once again, who support the show and get their questions answered, too. Appreciate that. This podcast is on Apple, Spotify, wherever you want to listen. Please find Seattle News, Views, and Brews on Patreon once again and show your support. Thanks for watching on Converge Media 2. We'll see you next time. Seattle News, Views, and Brews is an independent production of Callinan Media Services. Copyright 2024.